Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Justice Albie Sachs, in his book, The Jail Diary of Albie Sachs, was adapted into a play produced by the Royal Shakespeare Company and also a film that aired on British television 31 years ago. He is what is known as a living legend. By some estimations, the most famous judge in the world. Albie Sachs is the featured speaker at the Supreme Court of Ohio's Forum on the Law tomorrow at the Ohio Judicial Center. For more information, you can go to our website for a link. Joining us now is Albie Sachs. He's author, civil rights lawyer, political prisoner, and drafter of South Africa's Bill of Rights, and recently retired from the nation's high court. He's the author of The Strange Alchemy of Life and Law, The Soft Vengeance of a Freedom Fighter, and The Jail Diary of Albie Sachs. Welcome to the show, Justice Sachs.
Good morning to you.
Your career in human rights activism started in 1952 when you were 17 years old. You were in your second year at law school at the University of Cape Town, and you took part in the Defiance of Unjust Laws campaign. I want to hear about that campaign, but you've also said that you were born into the struggle.
Yes, well, my dad was a trade union leader, Solly Sachs, the General Secretary of the Garment Workers Union, and my mom, Ray. I was just born into it. She worked for an African leader named Moses Kotane, and she'd say, tidy up, tidy up, Uncle Moses is coming. And Uncle Moses wasn't Moses Cohen or Moses Levine, it was Moses Kotane. And he was an African leader, very prominent at the time. So being anti-racist was quite natural for me. I just saw the respect that she had for her employer. And so that seemed to be the normal world, and the world of racist South Africa seemed to be very abnormal.
So tell us about the Defiance of Unjust Laws campaign. What was happening back in 1952?
Well, that was similar to what became the sit-ins in the southern states of the USA. The difference perhaps being that it was started in 1952 by black people. The first person who sat in, as it were, was Nelson Mandela. He was the volunteer-in-chief. In April, and I was very keen to join in. I was at a meeting, and they called for volunteers, and I said, no, it's only for black people. But I said, but we're fighting against racism, and no, my friend told me. The leadership and the movement must clearly be seen as emanating from the oppressed community. But eventually, at the end of the year, the leadership said, okay, now's the time whites can join in, and I led a small group. There were four of us in Cape Town, and we sat down on seats marked non-whites only. So it was four white people sitting on seats marked non-whites only, and we were arrested.
As a group, what do you sense or what do you know about the numbers of whites that believed in the same things you did in South Africa at the time?
Yes, well, there were very, very few of us. I thought I'd get lots of my friends and fellow students to join in, but when it came to it, not so many were willing to volunteer to go to jail. But we had support from, I would say, several hundred students, emotional support, but the numbers willing to actually go underground, resist, never became very, very large. There was a much bigger group who were against apartheid, sort of in principle, and would help when they qualified as lawyers, defending people, architects, doctors, others using professional skills that might be useful. But I'm sad to say, overwhelmingly, the white people in South Africa supported apartheid. They didn't like the word, but they enjoyed the benefits of racism.
My guest is Albie Sachs. He's an author. Albie Sachs. He's an author, civil rights lawyer. He was a political prisoner. He is also one of the drafters of the South Africa's Bill of Rights. If you have a question or comment for Justice Sachs, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. In June 1955, you attended the Congress of the People in Kliptown, Soweto, Johannesburg.
Yes, that was very remarkable and had its origins actually in a meeting between an African leader, Professor Z.K. Matthews, and Paul Robeson, the great African-American singer and athlete and political figure in New York. And they came up with the idea, we denounce apartheid, we say it's bad, quite correctly, but what about our vision of a future free South Africa? Can't we adopt a charter that sets out the kind of democracy that we want one day in South Africa? And there we were, over 2,000 of us, many having escaped, got through various police dragnets and so on to get there. And clause by clause, we adopted the terms of the Freedom Charter that became really the centerpiece, the sort of vision of the African National Congress and its supporters and many other people who weren't in that organization. And I would say whose principles are really at the heart of the new South African constitution, which came when finally Nelson Mandela was released and ANC was unbanned, other organizations, and we negotiated our, I think, really wonderful constitution.
What was the governor's reaction back in 1955 to a movement like that?
Very clear. They sent large numbers of police on horseback, others with machine guns. They took the names of everybody there and eventually said that to demand democracy and equal rights for all in South Africa was treason. And the famous treason trial emerged from that. 156 top leaders were on trial eventually for about 5 or 6 years. It finally collapsed, the trial. It was such a ludicrous one. But they saw it as treason. To demand democracy was to be treasonous in South Africa.
Not long after that, you were just 21 years old and you were admitted to the bar and you began practicing law. You immediately started defending people charged under racial statutes and security laws under the South African apartheid.
Yes, I had a sort of schizophrenic legal practice because part of it was just the straightforward legal stuff, commercial work, crime, in its ordinary sense, divorces, marital, family problems, custody. And then the other half, but the most intensive half and the half that grew up to be about two-thirds, three-quarters, was defending people prosecuted under various racist and suppression laws, yeah.
And racial segregation began in colonial times, but apartheid became official policy on the books in 1948. So officially, it was still fairly new by then, and I was wondering if that helped or hindered you in your work defending...
Well, in the 1950s, we won just about all our cases. It was just at the margins of there wasn't very much we could do. We didn't have a Bill of Rights. We couldn't challenge laws as being unconstitutional because they were racist or denied people their basic rights. So we did what we could on the margins. But after 1960, there were massacres at Sharpeville and in Cape Town. A state of emergency was declared. The African National Congress, Pan-Africanist Congress, other organizations were banned. And then it wasn't possible even to protest, even to publicly demand in an open way that society ceased to be racist. And then the law changed. It became very, very severe. The onus of proof was put on the defense. People could be detained without trial for weeks, for months, for years. And the whole justice system was turned like inside out. And in the 1960s, we lost all our cases.
You were still very young. Were you ever afraid that they would hurt you?
No, I'm laughing, not because it was funny, but when I was arrested in 1952, I was 17, a second-year law student, and the magistrate saw that I was a juvenile. And he asked, were any of my parents in court? My mother stood up, and he sent me home to my mother as a juvenile. And I wanted to be this young leader of the protesting group. Mm-hmm. So my name was never mentioned in the press afterwards. But... sure, I was afraid. Not like just for me personally. The political issues were very clear. The apartheid was just terrible. It was unjust. It was cruel. It was wrong, and it was going to damage. It was damaging the country, and we just had to break through. So the real issue was, did I have enough courage to face up to the consequences? And it wasn't me alone. There was a whole group of us in the youth movement. And I think we each were frightened in our own ways. And it was like incremental. It wasn't as though the protesting was suddenly stopped and everything suddenly became dark. It was like a gradual evening and into the night. It got worse and worse and worse. And it was holding ground. And I might say when I was detained in solitary confinement afterwards, I had moments of terrible doubt. It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy at all. Isolation, no one to speak to, nothing to do, no activity, was extremely punishing. On a good day, I would just be depressed. That would be a good day. On a bad day, I would feel not quite suicidal, but in depths of misery that I'd never imagined a human being could experience.
In an interview in 2009 that I read, you said that the mental scars of your detention in 1963 and the solitary confinement and deep sleep deprivation remains as deeply embedded scars in my soul. You wrote about yourself, or you said about yourself, you've compared it to the car bombing that would come later and claimed your right arm.
Yes, people have difficulty understanding it, but the psychological and emotional damage done to me, particularly by the sleep deprivation, when I just collapsed onto the floor, they poured water on me, picked me up, I collapsed again, my body just aching for rest, and they were banging the table and shouting and then being quiet and so on, and overcoming my will, that sense of destruction, that trampling on dignity, remains with me, deeply embedded inside me. And in a strange way that some people find inexplicable, maybe even I can't understand, when I was blown up by a bomb put in my car by South African security agents and I lost my arm and the sight of an eye, in a strange way, it kind of liberated me. They'd done their worst. They'd done their most. It's like that day a freedom fighter's waiting for when they come for me. Will I be brave? Will I be courageous? Will I get through? Will I survive? And I had survived, and I felt fantastic. And so somehow that physical loss and re-entering the world as a new human being, learning to walk, to stand, to write with my left, to do simple things I'd done as a child, it was like coming into the world again with a tremendous sense of optimism and joy. That was 1988, and it's a sense of almost kind of faint continuing euphoria that I have to this day. And I just knew then, as I got better, my country would get better. It wasn't based on any evidence. It was just a conviction. And sure enough, 2 years later, I was able to return to South Africa from exile, help work on the country's new constitution. Very hard but glorious work for any legal person, and finally being appointed by Nelson Mandela to the Constitutional Court. It's just one series of beautiful events, and maybe even to continue the kind of fairy tale feel of it all, we had to build a new, like a castle on the hill. The new Constitutional Court was constructed in the heart of the prison where Gandhi and Mandela had both been locked up. It's a very beautiful building with lots of light and wonderful artwork, and it was quite marvelous working there. Mm-hmm. And if one has to complete the fairy tale the way these stories go, I met somebody, Vanessa September. We have a marvelous child, so great personal happiness has come towards the end of my life as well.
My guest is Justice Albie Sachs, author, civil rights lawyer, political prisoner at one point, and drafter of South Africa's Bill of Rights. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Seating for Justice Sachs' appearance for tomorrow's program is extremely limited. Those interested must reserve a seat by 1 p.m. today. Call 387-9402 or email events@sc.ohio.gov. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Neil Conan. In the coming week, we'll tell you why your darling tween turned into a sullen, risk-loving teen as we explore the teenage brain with National Geographic. Plus, the Political Junkie returns on Wednesday with a new trivia question. And Maria Bello joins us as she steps into some big shoes on the remake of Prime Suspect. That's all in the week ahead on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 62 degrees with cloudy skies in downtown Columbus at 10:21 this morning. Showers are likely off and on throughout the day, maybe a thunderstorm, a high of 68 degrees. Rain tonight, a low of 61. And cloudy for Tuesday, gradually becoming mostly sunny tomorrow afternoon, a high of 75.
Support for 89.7 comes from COSAI, presenting NPR's Neil Conan as he hosts The Evolution of Religion, a panel discussion about the intersection of science and religion at COSAI on October 5th at 7 p.m. More at COSAI.org.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking with Justice Albie Sachs, civil rights lawyer, political prisoner, drafter of South Africa's Bill of Rights, and recently retired from that nation's high court. He is the featured speaker at the Supreme Court of Ohio Forum on the Law tomorrow at the Ohio Judicial Center. If seating, as I said earlier, for that appearance is extremely limited, so if you're interested, you have to reserve a seat by 1 p.m. today. Call 387-9402 or email at events@sc.ohio.gov. Justice Sachs, when you were a young man, I was wondering if you wondered, what is the rest of the world thinking? Now, the world is much smaller now, and it's 24/7 news cycle and that kind of a thing, but did you wonder, where's the rest of the world? Why aren't they helping?
We were very, very tuned into the rest of the world. The rest of the world was fighting its own struggles. I mean, in the United States here, at the time I became politically active, the civil rights movement was really getting going in the 50s, and the famous Brown and Board of Education case was heard. We followed that very, very closely, and we got a lot of support from India from very early on when it became independent. As African countries became independent, they would support us in the United Nations. Mm-hmm. And Africa paid a very heavy price for its support of the anti-apartheid struggle. There was sabotage, bombings, assassinations, corruption, everything from apartheid. We had a lot of support from Europe, from in certain countries, United Kingdom and Scandinavian countries. And eventually, in the USA, the Free South Africa movement became very, very powerful. And I must say, I was astonished at how quickly it grew in the 1980s. And in the end, I think the final nail in the coffin of apartheid externally came when American banks refused to roll over loans to racist South Africa. And the rulers there realized now their last big friend, they imagined the United States would be their last big friend, even they couldn't support them anymore. And the apartheid people never managed to get credible, significant support from any black leaders inside the country. The movement, the mass movement against apartheid was getting stronger and stronger. Boycotts were emerging throughout the world. To this day, I meet people who refuse to eat our oranges or drink our wine. It was a little act at the time, but it was their form of identification with our struggle. So we did wonder about the rest of the world, but in the end, we were very grateful to the rest of the world for the huge support that we got.
I think that I first became aware of it in the mid-70s and during Model United Nations. I was Mauritania. So that, those kind of popped up about then, too. You were in exile in South Africa beginning in 1966, and you spent 11 years studying and teaching law in England. What were you able to do in England to help the struggle against apartheid in South Africa still?
There were two things. The one is I traveled everywhere. I got to know London marching from Hyde Park Corner to Trafalgar Square, not only on South Africa, but also on Vietnam, on other matters of interest. I met people from all over the world. I traveled the length and breadth of the United Kingdom, speaking to big groups, small groups, to get back up for the anti-apartheid struggle. The other thing was I was learning. All the time I felt I can immerse myself in British society totally because I know who I am. I am South African. I'm going to go back one day, and I must take back every bit of knowledge that will be useful for the rebuilding of our country. And I studied things like family law, English legal system in considerable detail, and took back a lot that was interesting. I got involved in cultural activities, jazz. So I felt very alive when I was in England, although I must say I was never happy there, in the sense of I never felt really comfortable, so far from home, so far away in terms of climate and culture and values from my part of the world. Even when I was happy in England, I was unhappy. But when I moved to Mozambique after 11 years...
In 1977,
yeah. Yes, even when I was unhappy, I was happy. I just felt so involved, this newly independent country close to South Africa. The problems of education, of health, of overcoming racism, struggle for rights for women, all of these things were very much on the agenda. It was a glorious period for me, not without difficulty. There were great shortages. There was civil war. Eventually, as you mentioned, I was blown up. I lost my arm. But I have enormous affection for that country. And also, interestingly, when I flew to England, I was flown comatose to England. I flew first class for the first time in my life, and I was comatose. I couldn't even enjoy it. And I recovered in the London hospital. There was just something about the way the nurses bathed my body and bound my wounds, and their tenderness and their care gave me a love and affection for Britain that I hadn't had in my previous 11 years there. So these are two countries of my exile, Mozambique and the UK, that are very close to me. I also traveled extensively in the United States, and there was one young guy at St. Louis who really helped me. Sometimes people ask an awkward question, and it makes you rethink things. And this guy had his, must have been about 12, and he had his hand in his pocket and trying to be kind of cocky and stand his ground with his visiting speaker. And he said, please excuse my accent, but he said, "My brother tells me that problem with people like you is you're always fighting for somebody else. And what you ought to be doing is fighting for your own liberation." And I thought, no, I'm not fighting for someone else. I'm fighting for me, for my dignity. I can't be a free person in my country if the majority of people are being oppressed and subjected to inhuman conditions. So I joined in a struggle that was overwhelmingly a black struggle, but it wasn't for their liberation, it was for our liberation. So I owe this guy, he's probably a grandfather by now, quite a big debt of gratitude for forcing me into thinking, why am I in the struggle? And I wasn't in the struggle to fight on behalf of somebody else, it was for my dignity.
Well, once you did start fighting for the rights, you know, and for things to change, you were treated as if you were treated as if you were non-white.
I was treated in some ways as even worse, because in terms of the racist ideology, black people didn't have leadership and complaints and capacity to think for themselves. It had to be some white person in the background who was the mastermind manipulating them. And maybe that was one reason I was targeted for the bombing. And of course, it was absolutely ludicrous. I worked, had the great joy and pleasure of working with marvelous people like Oliver Tambo, who was one of the great leaders of the 20th century, the legal partner and friend of Nelson Mandela, not as well known as Nelson Mandela, but equal to him in terms of the kind of the warmth and generosity and inclusiveness of his vision, his thoughtfulness. It was quite brilliant for me working under his leadership rather than trying to be a leader in this very big and growing movement.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Justice Albie Sachs. Draft South Africa's Bill of Rights. If you have a question or comment for Justice Sachs, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I was going to ask you this later, but you made me think about it when you were talking about moving to England and before you went on to Mozambique. And that would be culture shock. You talked a little bit about values, but censorship was pretty ingrained in the South African society. And I was wondering how that might have affected your ability to, you know, move about with more comfort in England, at least at first.
Oh, no, I loved it. And the 60s, that was a fantastic time. You know, it was the time of the new fashions in dress, Mary Quant, the satires, a Private Eye newspaper, the irreverence. I just lapped it up. It was marvelous. I think it's become sometimes a little bit too sardonic, sometimes even cruel, the irreverence. But it was a great time to be there, and I couldn't get enough of it.
So it was ingrained then, and I was wondering how it's endured in free South Africa among the oppressed and the oppressor.
We're a very, very open society, and the Constitution speaks about an open and democratic society, and freedom of speech is strongly enshrined in the Constitution, and freedom of creativity and so on. And one of the first cases our court had was to strike down laws that allowed for censorship of film material. And right now there are huge debates going on about legislation going through Parliament dealing with secrecy and possession of secret documents. I can't comment on that because these issues could very well reach the courts. But what I can say is South Africans speak their mind. They've got used to speaking their mind. The biggest growth industry in South Africa today is stand-up comedians. And they come from every community, every walk of life. And I think that's very, very healthy. So we are a spirited society. And we know about the problems of abuse, of corruption, and so on, because people are speaking out.
In 1990, you were invited to South Africa by then-President de Klerk to take part in negotiations to end apartheid. What was that like to return to South Africa after being away for 22 years?
Well, I wasn't invited by him.
Oh,
I just turned up there.
Okay, sorry.
I didn't have any documents, and the guy who met me at the airport, it's quite marvelous. He was from a conservative, Afrikaans-speaking sort of background. And he just said, "Welcome home, Albie." And I still bump into him occasionally at the airport. I had to battle to get proper permits and so on. I wasn't going to beg. This was my country. I was stateless when I left. It was glorious to be back. And it was coming back to a country that was changing dramatically and rapidly. And there was only one way we could go, and that was towards democracy. They weren't easy years. There was a lot of violence, a kind of half-civil war in KwaZulu-Natal area. Lots of people were dying. People afterwards were thrown off trains. So it wasn't kind of all milk and honey and roses and sweetness. But the movement was in one direction only, and that was towards democracy. And I was exhausted most of the time, traveling, writing, speaking, arguing. Hardly time to speak, but it's the sort of thing I think any citizen would feel joyous about. But if you're a lawyer, imagine you're working on your country's constitution. I wasn't the author of the Bill of Rights, but I certainly made a big contribution together with many, many, many others. And there was something exhilarating about being involved in that project. After decades of being against, to pull down, to destroy an evil system, I think many of us just ached for a chance to heal, to build, to nurse, to nurture. A whole side of ourselves had been repressed, and even at a purely personal psychological level, it was wonderful to be on the side, if you like, of the angels rather than simply combating the devils.
So you said you weren't invited to South Africa in 1990 for that, but you went. You just showed up, but just 2 years before that, that was when your car was bombed and you were blown up. What changed to make you think it was safe enough to go back to South Africa in 1990?
No, what President de Klerk did at the time, and he deserves credit for that, was that he announced in Parliament that the African National Congress would be unbanned, the Pan-Africanist Congress, South African Communist Party, which meant that they could function legally and that Nelson Mandela would be released. And that was the signal that he gave. In terms of the returning, it wasn't made all that easy. I just turned up then.
Okay.
Throw me into jail if you like, again. this time I knew that the current was, the tide was in our direction.
So what was it like to sit at a table with people who had been responsible for so much injustice and suffering, not on the part of the nation as well as yourself personally?
Well, I remember the very first day of negotiations. We all put on our suits, and I didn't sleep the night before. And I just couldn't. I was terrified that somehow we would negotiate badly and we would lose at the negotiating table what people had won so hard through loss of life, people tortured to death, the struggles and so on. And we came into it was a big kind of reception area, and there I saw, we used to call them the enemy, and then it became, as negotiations advanced, it became the other side. We softened the language a little bit. And I guess they were wondering, you know, they're dealing with these terrorists. I was very, very nervous. I'm sure we all were. But the minute you start, you sit around the table, you actually negotiate, it's partly the lawyer takes over, your brain is working, your heart is pumping. It's dealing with words and what words we want in the documents. And I imagine surgeons are like that when they actually cut. Then you forget the tension. You get totally absorbed and involved in the task. The adrenaline flows in that way, not in anticipation and fear, but in terms of activity. And it was a long time. We spent a couple of years. Breakdowns. It wasn't easy. It wasn't just nice, rational people sitting around a table. How can we agree? Terrible breakdowns and massacres, rolling mass action. But eventually, as I keep saying now, the tide was in favor of democracy. We pushed and pushed and pushed. And maybe because it was such a strenuous experience, our constitution, I think, is very robust. It's very tough. It's deeply rooted in the kind of psyche of the nation. And it kind of embodies our deep best aspirations and values, with a strong feeling of never again, the kinds of terrible things that happened, that's made it a model constitution for the world.
When you're observing near and far the Arab Spring, what do you think about, and what lessons might be applied to these emerging?
Yes, in fact, I've been to Cairo. Mm-hmm. I went to a conference organized by the United Nations Development Program. And the issues were so similar to issues we were debating in the 90s about transition, about how to get a constitution. Should there be a Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Yeah.
Should everybody be sent to jail? So the issues are very similar. I think each country has to find its own way forward. But the spirit in Cairo was wonderful. I went to Tahrir Square. I bought a whole bunch of T-shirts there. And I felt that sense of ebullience and expectation that we had in the 1990s. There was a lot that we could share. Not to say do this, do that, don't do the other. We hated it when people tried to point us in what they thought was the right direction. But we loved it when people shared their own experiences with us, debated with us. And I'm hoping to go back there again, maybe to Tunisia. And people from Libya have also been in touch with me. So if we can pass on any of our experiences, and I'm not the only one from South Africa, mm-hmm. if we can feed them in to their debates, we'd be only too happy to do so.
My guest is Justice Albie Sachs, author, civil rights lawyer, political prisoner, one of the drafters of the South Africa's Bill of Rights. If you have a question or comment for him, we welcome them. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, where the idea for the show Breaking Bad came from. We'll talk to Vince Gilligan. He's the show's executive producer. And we'll also hear from Aaron Paul, whose character has evolved into one tough drug dealer. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides and a discussion of redistricting, Senate Bill 5, and much more in Ohio politics with a panel of State House reporters. Join us for hour two of All Sides at 11 on 89.7.
Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio Northern University, where a student-centered environment and nationally ranked arts, sciences, and professional programs help students discover their true north. Experience ONU Days October 12th and 15th. Information is at onu.edu.
Be sure to visit wosu.org/allsides. You can watch a live stream of our show and also check out the audio and video archive. wosu.org/allsides. Cloudy skies today with showers and possibly a thunderstorm, a high of 68. Rain showers are likely tonight as well, a low of 61. Some sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 75. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Albie Sachs. He's an author, civil rights lawyer, political prisoner, and one of the drafters of South Africa's Bill of Rights, also recently retired from the South Africa's High Court. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Alex from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Hey, welcome, and really love your topic, the way that you really sincerely listen to your guests.
Thank you, Alex.
I had to call and ask whether or not there's the recording, whether there was a recording of the process of the reconciliation, either the formulation of it and the implementation of it, whether or not it was any recording so that for posterity, so people can actually learn and watch the actual historic event. That's it.
Justice Sachs?
Yes, you know, one of my projects now that I'm very deeply involved in is doing a full oral history of how we actually negotiated the Constitution, because the recording you're speaking about doesn't exist. We've got portions of it have been filmed, and the press carried portions of the public thing, but a lot of the internal debates inside the ANC, inside the old racist government, and even some of the public debates haven't been recorded. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission proceedings were all recorded. Films have been made about that, and that's a little bit better, but even those are not so easy to come by. So I think it's a very, very good question, and particularly now with the Arab Spring, people clamoring for an understanding of how we did. It seemed impossible. How is it possible after centuries of racial oppression, after all the humiliations and indignities, the cruelties, the tortures, how could black and white live together as equals, as fellow citizens, human beings in one country? And we pulled it off, not without difficulty, and we still have huge problems today, but basically the foundations of our country are good, and perhaps that's my biggest life project for the years to come, is to help in the memorializing of the actual process in a very, very honest way.
Thanks, Alex, for that call. You mentioned earlier, Justice Sachs, that you didn't like it when people tried to point you in the right direction in the process of pulling together the South African Constitution in the direction of what they thought, you know, was proper. And I wondered, you know, now the South African Constitution is widely regarded as being the most progressive in the world, or one of the most progressive. And how does that, your Constitution and Bill of Rights, stack up to the American Constitution? And how much did you take from the American Constitution? You mentioned British law, but what about American?
No, what we said to people is, tell us how you do things. We will take what's useful for us. And we'd lived everywhere. We'd lived in the United States, in Canada, in the Soviet Union. We'd lived in India. We'd lived all over Africa. We saw systems at first hand. We'd lived in East Germany, West Germany. So we had a lot of hands-on experience of what worked and what didn't work. Everybody told us, you must do it the way we do it. It's the best, except the Canadians. Only the Canadians said, don't follow our system of federalism. It gives too much power to the states. There are lots of conflicts. Everybody else seemed to think the Germans thought they were the best, the French thought they were the best, the English didn't even have a constitution.
Right.
They thought they were the best. So, but we certainly took an enormous amount. The whole separation of powers construct, which came with the U.S. Constitution, we took from the U.S. of A. From Canada, we took the structure of our Bill of Rights. They had a new Charter of Rights in 1982. It was fairly fresh, the balancing of it. From Germany, we took the idea of a constitutional court. We also took the concurrent powers. The big battle in our country was who would have the powers, the central government or the states. And in the end, they both have the powers to deal with most important things. A few things are reserved only for the central government. But in some circumstances, the provincial powers, legislation would prevail. In others, the national would prevail. And from India, we took a finance and fiscal commission, very important in terms of directing revenue. And finally, from Namibia, we took the whole non-racial project. So each of the continents provided us with something that was useful. But in the end, we just had to do it ourselves, work it out ourselves. It took 6 years. 6 years ultimately. And in the end, intriguingly, the Constitution had to be referred to the Constitutional Court to ratify, to accept that it complied with certain principles agreed to in advance. And now I'm Judge Alby Sachs, sitting with 10 colleagues on the court, and we actually struck down the Constitution as being unconstitutional because, although overwhelmingly it was okay, in 9 respects, it failed to measure up to what had been agreed to in advance. So it was a very prolonged, meticulous, intense process rooted in our reality and our capacities and possibilities. And I think that's what gave it enormous strength, but drawing on the best that we could get from anywhere in the world.
We have an email from Hal. He writes, I used to use your constitution as a model of how human rights should be protected. But economically and in criminal justice, isn't there a huge gap between the rhetoric and implementation of your constitution?
Okay, very, very fair question. We have economic, social rights enshrined in the constitution, the right of access to adequate housing, to health, to food and water, to welfare, to education. And millions of our people are still homeless. And although we have a wonderful program of child support and support for the elderly, so we don't have starvation in our country, we still have a lot of hunger, we have unemployment. But I wouldn't call it simply rhetoric. These are meaningful rights. And really, it's up to governments to ensure that they are fulfilled in practice. The democratic process has a big role to play. What the Constitution does is keep aloft at all times the importance of sustaining the dignity of everybody, and it at least provides mechanisms if there are serious gross abuses. The legal system, the court system can be used to deal with them. But in the end, it's not the courts, it's not the Constitution that builds the houses, provides the hospitals and the jobs. That's got to be done through the democratic process, through the development of the economy.
In 2005, the Constitutional Court made same-sex marriages legal in South Africa. And you were the author of the court's holding in the case, Minister of Home Affairs versus, I think, Fourie,
yes.
In which the court overthrew South Africa's statute that defined marriage to be between one man and one woman as a violation of the Constitution's general mandate for equal protection for all and its specific mandate against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. That is considered a model around the world now, and only a few countries match it.
Yes. We didn't actually overthrow the marriage law,
okay,
in the sense that it's still possible for heterosexuals to marry.
Oh, yeah, so of course,
we,
right.
We kept the law. Now, this is a purely technical thing, but not not important. The marriage law was fine as far as it went, but it was under-inclusive. It invisibilized. It didn't acknowledge the importance of the rights of same-sex couples to have their intimacy, their love and respect for each other publicly recognized, and to accept, to get the status and accept the responsibilities of being married. And we declared that that was unconstitutional for insufficiency of the law. And I must say, at that time, maybe we did stand out. I think there were four other countries in the world that had, mainly through legislation, achieved that. I think the number's grown enormously since then, and it's been very striking how quickly the world is catching up.
You were there was another interesting ruling that was groundbreaking and really almost unthinkable still in the United States, and it was a decision not to send a woman to prison because it would infringe on the human rights of her three children.
Yes. That was a case I remember it so vividly because when I first saw it, I thought it was hopeless. She was just wasting our time. We shouldn't even hear the matter. And one of my colleagues said, "But Albie, have you thought about the rights of her children, not her rights to be with her children?" She had committed credit card fraud once, twice, three times, even when she was out on bail under a suspended sentence. And it made me look at the matter in a completely fresh way. And in the end, we got reports from social welfare people about the children, and we decided to keep her out of jail. She had to do community service, quite extensive community service. She had to repay the people she'd defrauded. She wasn't getting off scot-free by any means. But that the children growing up in an area, it was euphemistically called fragile, an area of drugs and gangs, she was a marvelous mother. She was on the Parent Teachers Association. There was clearly some kind of psychological compulsion that led her to go in for the credit fraud. She'd been clean for 5 years, and the majority of the court agreed that if we looked at the matter from the point of view of the interests of the children, which our Constitution protects, then she shouldn't go to jail. And that has been picked up in many parts of the world, and people are reconsidering sentencing practices, not to allow a murderer, somebody who does something terrible, to say, "I mustn't go to jail because my children will be badly affected," but in cases where you can possibly say, okay, you throw into the balance not simply the right of the primary caregiver, usually the mother, to be with the children, but the rights of the children not to, in effect, be left parentless without direction, without support. And it's that principle's being followed in South Africa quite extensively now. It just requires a different vision on the part of the sentencing judicial officers.
We have an email from Bob. He asks, how are U.S. policy and action regarding race relations received by people in other countries? Are there things the United States can do to earn being taken more seriously?
Well, just as we didn't like people telling us what to do, I'm not so keen to tell people here what to do. You know, we find everything in the United States, the best and the worst, and I'm not going to tell you what I think is the best or what I think is the worst, but there are terrific people in this country who've been fighting very, very hard. I feel very at home and comfortable with them. People outside do notice the fact that in spite of the law, in spite of the Constitution, questions of race are still strong in this country. Many are puzzled by the fact that affirmative action is not regarded as something appropriate, that it can be struck down by the highest court in the land. Things like that could be challenged. But we come here to learn what we can and to tell of our experience. And if people find things in our experience are useful here, then so be it. We are only too happy.
I was just listening to a BBC report on the way in today about an opera that's based on the story of a woman who, from the Holocaust, when she was imprisoned in Auschwitz, she what would happen if she met one of her guards during that period many years later. And in 2008, you met the person who organized the placing of the bomb in your car 20 years earlier. What happened?
Yes, he came, he telephoned. I was in my chambers at court. Could he come and see me? And I remember going to the security door and opening it with my heart really beating quite hard. And I looked at him and, gosh, this is the guy who tried to kill me. And he's looking at me, gee, this is the man I tried to kill. We'd never met each other. We'd never fought over anything, over money or love or position. But he was on that side. I was on this side. And we talked and talked and talked and talked, and eventually after an hour or two, I said, his name was Henry, I said, Henry, I stood up, I have to get on with my work. Normally when I say goodbye to someone, I shake that person's hand. I can't shake your hand. But go to the Truth Commission, tell them what you know, and maybe we'll meet one day, who knows. And he went away looking a little bit kind of disconsolate. I forgot about him. And then several months later, end of the year, I'm at a party. We judges worked very, very hard. I was tired. The music was loud. I went with a friend. And I hear a voice that says, Albie. And I look around. Albie. My God, it's Henry. And he's calling me by my first name. And he's beaming. And he comes up to me. And we get into a corner so that the music can't overwhelm what we're trying to say to each other. And I said, what happened? And he said, I went to the Truth Commission and I spoke to Bobby and Sue and Farouk, again using first names of people who'd been in exile with me. And I told them everything I knew, and you said that one day. And I said, Henry, looking into your eyes, I believe you're telling me the truth. And I put out my hand, my left hand, now I'd lost my right arm. And I shook his hand, and he went away absolutely elated. I almost fainted. But I heard, Anne, that afterwards he was enjoying himself at the party. He suddenly withdrew, and he went home and he cried for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And that moved me quite intensely. He's not my friend. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to go to a movie with him. But if he sat down next to me in a bus, I would say, oh, Henry, how are you getting on? It's like we're living in the same country.
Justice Sachs, thanks so much. It's been an honor speaking with you today.
Well, thank you, and thanks to the listeners.
Justice Albie Sachs, author, civil rights lawyer, political prisoner, and one of the drafters of South Africa's Bill of Rights, as I said earlier, who will be speaking at the Ohio Supreme Court. If you're interested, go to 387-9402 or email at events@sc.ohio.gov. Seating is extremely limited. You need to call by 1 o'clock today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.